Hey folks, welcome to the show. Hi Sharad, how's it going, man?
It's going very well. And have you noticed that based on some of our mandates that we are working on, some of our podcasts, we're seeing a little bit of an uptick in real estate friendly businesses, right?
Yes, or some downtick from fintech.
Like the new theme is the real estate or real estate proxies, be it sort of bonds or maintenance companies or even hotels, right?
But today, to be fair, we are, I think, at a nice confluence between real estate and fintech in a way. So without further ado, would love to welcome Rahul Khetawat, head of offline sales at Property Share. Property Share is a platform for commercial real estate investments. Rahul, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Rahul, so you lead channel sales at Property Share. Why don't we, just get a quick background in your role within the organization?
Basically, personally, I joined Property Share about a year ago. And prior to me joining, most of our journey, till last year in terms of fundraising was directly through the platform, right? So we were, I would say 99% a B2C company in that sense, right? However, Kunal and Hakim, both our co-founders, a couple of years ago realized that, while we are doing very well in terms of raising funds through the platform, in terms of the scale, right, and especially the scale that, we're kind of looking at, which I can talk about a little later, if you really want to get to the scale that we wanted to, we needed to kind of have a vertical which is focused on building partnerships in the existing ecosystem. Because while the online digital world is growing, most of the wealth in India is still managed offline, right? And which is why this vertical got set up, I joined, and since then it's been a very interesting journey. So I primarily focus on, basically partners. So be it financial advisors, real estate consultants, family offices, institutional, players. So I basically focus on all partners who support and work with us, when we kind of fundraising, right? And fundraising could be in different ways. So we also run a fund AIF tattoo fund for which we raise funds. And then we have our normal bread and butter products that we also sell, which we raise funds for.
So, I mean, just to
get a sense on the core business at PropShare, right? Like, can we just, for the benefit of our listeners and personally for our benefit as well, just how does sort of the platform work and what, we get a high level idea sort of which democratizing investments in commercial grade real estate. We get that, but how does it sort of work? Like, what as an investor am I looking to do on the platform?
Okay, so before I directly answer that question, sir, maybe if it is okay, I would kind of go back to the genesis of the company itself,
sure.
Right?
Sure.
Our CEO, Kunal, was one of the founding members of the Blackstone Real Estate Fund in India, right? Back in 2007. And he basically worked with Blackstone till 2015, right? Mm-hmm. So he primarily saw the whole landscape of institutional funds entering India in the commercial real estate segment. And he saw that as a huge opportunity because as an asset class, right?
Yeah.
That was an asset class which was, the playground of only the institutional and the UHNIs at that point, right?
Yeah.
So the reason why he kind of left Blackstone to start PropShare was to really say it's such an attractive asset class. You get rented yields anywhere in the range of 8 to 9%. And the capital appreciation is phenomenal. And retail investors have zero play in it, right? So why not we do something to make this asset class, right, with the same level of diligence that institutional players do, available to retail investors, right? And it is with that thought that Property Share basically started, right? And
I guess the timing is sort of before even the first REIT was listed, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So at that point, there was absolutely nothing, right? So there was no REITs, there was, no platform. So we were the first ones, not just in India, but actually at that point in time in the world, mm-hmm. to come up with a model like this for commercial real estate, right? And we started in 2015. Kunal and Hashim, both batchmates from IIM Ahmedabad, basically came together. Hashim was more on the tech side and, more on the marketing side. And Kunal, obviously, coming from the business, from investments. And that's how they came together. And it's been, 8 years, a wonderful journey. And we started with, I think, the first asset that they funded was, I think, a 3 crore asset. We started with that. And then, we just a couple of months ago closed an asset which was 370 crores, right? So it's been a very fulfilling journey and a journey where, we've obviously seen how retail investors have continued to show interest and grow their interest in something like this, right? So currently our AUM is roughly at about 1,400 odd crores. And we expect that by end of the we should be close to about 2,500 crores in terms of AUM. Yeah. So that's a little bit about property share, right? Now coming to how do retail investors participate, right? So I think you mentioned a while ago we are a tech-enabled platform, right? So I think we built the process in a way that any investor from any part of the world can actually buy and sell and go through the entire process without having to sign any physical paper or without having to go anywhere, right? And he can do this entire transaction from Timbuktu, if you may, right? And the way we have enabled it is, the basic essential model is we don't sell real estate, right, to investors. What the investors actually invest in are securities of a SPV, a private company, private limited company, which back to back then is owning that real estate, right? So all basically has real estate as the underlying asset, right? So in this way, what we've been able to do is we've been able to cut out the complete hassle for an investor who otherwise would have to, come to the registration office when you have to register the property and then again come to the registration office when you have to sell the property. You have to do 5 other papers which you physically need to sign. So we've cut that entire process out for investors, and not to mention also, making it a hassle-free, operation, because we then also enable management of the property, including tenancy, including releasing, et cetera, which the investors don't need to then worry about. So from an investor's perspective, he is investing in real estate as a financial product, mm-hmm. right? And then only looking at returns that he can get. One is recurring, and then obviously the capital appreciation that he gets, when you exit the property.
Does one underlying, let's say a piece of land, which is 1 crore, is it mapped to one investor or sort of does the value translate into a 1:1? If the asset is 1 crore, then you can get an exposure of 1 crore or you can
sort of multiple. Yeah. So let me give you an example, right? Maybe it will be easier. So let's say we are going to buy a property of 100 crores. Yeah. And let's say that we have an SPV, say an ABC Private Limited, right, which is going to then eventually own the asset, yeah? One point to note here is one SPV only holds one asset, right? So it's not that same SPV will have other assets, right? So let's say ABC Private Limited is the company which will eventually hold this 100 crore asset when you buy it, right? And you are an investor, you would like to invest 1 crore, right? So what will happen is you will be issued 1% of equity shares plus CCDs of this ABC Private Limited, right? So by the virtue of your 1 crore investment, you essentially own 1% of ABC Private Limited, right? And by the virtue of owning 1% of ABC Private Limited, you then are also getting, your let's say your rentals every month. So 1% of entire rentals that VC Private Limited gets, you then it gets passed on to you.
So essentially, you're fractionalizing the process, which institutional investor is looking at, right? I mean, effectively, like say if there's a pre-leased commercial building, which I as a fund am looking at, say that commercial building is, you know, like generating, I don't know, 1 crore of annual rent. I'll probably have a view on the expected cash flows. I'll put some sort of a rental yield assumption on that. Say that asset is worth 100, and on the supply end, you are basically converting it into a unit and distributing it to individuals or smaller category investors, correct? Through your platform.
Yes.
But I mean, to kind of just finish my chain of thought, I mean, and within the list, I mean, obviously you guys started pre-REITs, but now we are in a, you know, paradigm where REITs are fairly, I won't say they're prevalent, but they're kind of, you know, picking up one way or the other. But in REITs, the one thing which I think is a very essential sell for any retail investor always is that there is a very high percentage of, you know, cash flow generation, which is insured on day one, in the sense that there is low development risk. Within your segment, do you have any internal thresholds that you keep?
Yeah. So I think it's a very, very good point to bring out. So I'll tell you, you know, for us, what are the 3-4 cornerstones, right? When we look at, I mean, the kind of shortlist properties. By the way, I think our investment team today is, you know, at any point in time is looking at tens of properties, at any point in time. And for them, they have these 4-5 cornerstones that you basically use to, you know, shortlist properties. So, you know, we, number one, do not invest in any property which is under construction.
Right.
We only buy fully completed pre-leased assets, right? That basically ensures there's zero development risk. That ensures that we are buying a property which has rent coming in from day one. So there's zero tenancy risk or, risk of you not getting rent because you're not getting a tenant. Then, so that's one. We look at properties, you know, in the range of 7-9% of rental yield, right? So we would not look at a property or an asset which is anywhere below that, right? So that's, 7-9% is the bare minimum that you look at. It differs from city to city in India. Certain cities, just going by the trend, have a slightly lower rental yield, certain have higher, but that's how we do it. Third, we only invest in tier one Indian cities. And we have also started to now invest in markets abroad, like the United Kingdom, where we now have 3 warehouses.
Right,
thereby giving investors the opportunity to also diversify their portfolio globally, right? And the fourth is we ensure that the tenant quality in that particular asset is either a hybrid MNC or an Indian MNC, as we call it, right? So it needs to necessarily be a grade A plus tenant, otherwise you don't go for it, yeah? And fifth is obviously the quality of the asset, right? So which needs to be platinum, a lead platinum or a lead gold at least,
So, and for an investor who's sort of issued a unit, let's say, based on how much he or she's investing, how does the liquidity, when someone wants to exit their investment, right? How does that valuation discovery happen at that, for that liquidity event, right? If I want to sort of, after 1 year, sort of get out of it, at what value? I mean, I've taken in on the cash flows that I've generated from rent that has been passed on to me, but what about the principal appreciation? How does that value get calculated?
So, see, I mean, we basically, for the investors, there's no lock-in at all, right? So what we do is we enable a resale window every quarter. Right.
Okay.
And in that resale window, we've got more than, 200,000 plus users on our platform. Right. And in that resale window, every investor has the opportunity of putting up his or her unit for sale at a price which they feel is right. Right. Now, what we as a team enable is we guide the investor depending on the urgency of the funds that they need on what price might be the right price. Because we have visibility also on, what the users are kind of saying, at which price it might sell, right? So we kind of recommend that, but it's completely up to the investor, right?
So it's almost essentially like a secondary market, but you're just
Exactly. So we play the role of a marketplace there, right?
Yeah.
Where the investor can put up the unit for sale at a price they feel right, and then we kind of have it broadcasted to back 200,000 plus users who then have the opportunity to buy it, right? So that's one. And obviously, I think the maximum benefit that investors get is when we exit the entire asset, right? So normally our holding period for an asset is, I would say, anywhere between 4 to 5 years, right? So depending on the market size, et cetera, we would start the soft marketing of an asset from year 3 onwards and close a deal, after year 4 or something like that. So year 4 is when we typically try to exit an asset completely, right? And that's why what we always also advise investors when they are about to invest with us is if they do not foresee this investment with a time horizon of at least 3 years, then they are better off not investing because, in real estate, for you to be able to really see capital appreciation, capital gain, right, you need to spend at least that amount of time. Now, obviously, the reason why we run the resale window every quarter is to ensure that if for unforeseen reasons, if somebody does want to exit, they have a window to exit, right? But our typical advice to investors is, if you have a time horizon of at least 3 years in mind, then it's a good product for you to invest in, right? And also there's the taxation, the whole taxation angle where, you only get tax 20% minus indexation if you exit, after 3 years of holding, right?
Right.
So and what is your exit discipline like for exiting an asset? Like, why, you say 4 years or 5 years, like why 4 years or 5 years? Is it sort of, are those internal benchmarks that you think the property is appreciated to an amount that makes sense to you? Because it seems like if you've got high quality tenants, and I suspect that most of your tenants will be put on a annual rent escalation as well. So from a yield standpoint, I suspect that the story goes on, right? So why is it to manage internal liquidity, or what is the discipline around
that? A very, very good question. Actually, I get asked this question a lot of times from investors, right? Saying, why do you want to exit after 4 years? You've got a 9% rental deal, you've got a 7-year lock-in. So let's just stay for 7, 8, 9 years, right? And, for us, the reason is very simple, right? I mean, a lot of times, the biggest fear of an investor, right, who is investing in real estate is liquidity. Right, because in his or her mind, buying a real estate asset is very easy, but getting out of it can sometimes take years. Right, and as a principal, that's why we've said, it is very important for us to make investors see real capital appreciation. Right, so this is not something that is just there on an Excel sheet or which comes to you as an email saying, Colliers did an annual valuation of the property and it's increased by XYZ percent, right? But you see real money coming, right? And that also builds confidence in the investor's mind that all of this is not just something that is put on paper, right? Because you do get exits and you do get appreciation. So, we've made exits as high, as high as returning 80-90% IRR to investors, right? And the beauty of this is that when investors see this return coming in, almost 80-90% of the money basically comes back to us in our next asset. Yeah, because now the investor in his mind is convinced that, this is not just a blue sky story that is being sold, right? I mean, the exit has happened. I've seen the money come into my bank account. And, therefore, the confidence level of investing further and higher, investment amount goes up. Yeah.
Yeah.
So is it like right to characterize that, considering you look at 100% pre-leased assets, effectively when the first check is signed, it primarily gives a kind of a secondary or a exit to the developer, correct? I mean, that's how the classic use case is for like a new project?
So, I mean, we bought assets from developers, we bought assets from funds, we bought assets.
Yeah, I mean, on the secondary, it's different, right? I mean, once it's out there, it's out there, right?
Yeah.
But that's the idea, right? I mean, and what about your own What about the kind of balance sheet exposure that you guys personally take here effectively? Because you mentioned that now you have also set up an AIF. So I'm assuming that when your journey started, it was purely like a syndicated offering, right? Where you were serving as an originator of sorts. But now I'm sure you're getting full service in your offering.
Yeah.
And I guess you're also acting as operators now, right? In the asset once you guys have taken over.
So we have multiple products, right? So we still continue to have the, you know, the asset by asset product where our, let's say our investment amount or property shares investment amount in that asset-based thing is pretty much zero.
Yeah.
But on the AIF side, you know, we obviously got to have a skin in the game. So we do about 5%
right.
contribution from property share in the AIF. And then from the first AIF that we raised, we have now deployed the entire amount of that AIF into the last four assets that we bought, right? And we're actually thinking of now raising the second AIF very soon. Right. So from that perspective, which is why, you know, when you said fractionalizing, I mean, in our minds, you know, the whole fractional piece is just one part of our offering, right? We've got multiple offerings.
Because on the AIF end, you can't go below 1 crore in any case, right? From a fractionalization standpoint also, right?
Exactly.
But on the syndicated deals, you probably can go slightly, it's more customizable for you, right?
So we start the investment from 25 lakhs onwards right. and then in units of 5 lakhs, you can keep adding.
What's your view on, I mean, obviously now with REITs coming into the picture, how has the game changed for you? Because there it's a highly regulated offering, right? Obviously it has checks off most of the boxes that you guys are anyways checking off, right? Plus, I think there is more, I would say, systematic recourse available to retail investors one way or the other. What do you say?
Absolutely. And I think we, you know, tried to also ensure, so we kind of did a, you know, 3 years ago, we kind of, you know, changed the model a little bit and we said, you know, let us try to self-govern ourselves through SEBI. And that's why we also registered investment advisor for every asset that we saw. Therefore, you know, SEBI, our investors all have the recourse to go to SEBI even today because we continue to be the investment advisors for them. But having said this, you're right. You know, there's a very clear regulation for REITs. And, you know, I think 3 months ago, SEBI also came up with a consultation paper for ensuring, I think, you know, clear regulation also for, you know, our kind of business, which is, you know, fractional or, you know, AIF-based fractional investment, right? Otherwise, you know, after the REITs come in, actually, it's impacted us very positively, right? Because now people understand the space quite better, right? From what it used to be before the REITs were there. There are still a few things that you can do with in our model of investment versus the REIT. So for example, a REIT will never give you the chance to invest in a micro market, in a particular city, in a particular asset, right? Because it's always a group of assets that you are going to be investing in. Which is different in our parlance. So for you as an investor, if you like Bangalore as a city much more than a Bombay or a Pune, you can decide to invest in an asset in Bangalore, in Outer Ring Road, for example. Yeah?
Sure.
Yeah. Because that's where you believe you will be able to get maximum depreciation, right? The other bit that is quite different compared to a REIT is our returns are far more than what a REIT. So a REIT today would be anywhere, depending on which REIT you look at, would be anywhere between 5 to 6.5%. Yeah.
Right.
Versus our returns, rental yields are in the 8-9% range. Right. And the difference is primarily because in a REIT, you know, you would, about 20-25% of the money is invested in land and in under construction projects,
mm-hmm.
which obviously gives zero yield. Mm-hmm. Right. Versus in our model, 100% of your money is invested in rent yielding asset. Yeah, So that's the other difference. And four, I think, you know, in terms of capital protection, right? So you know, a lot of our investors also like to invest because they feel, if after investing of four to five years, they will be able to ensure, if not a big appreciation, at least the capital that they invested. Which again, in a REIT is, you know, it's basically like a share, right? So you cannot predict which way the prices of the REIT go, and it depends on where you've entered versus, you know, when you're going to exit, right?
In a typical property that you identify, like, do you sort of invest any upfront capex in it to sort of spruce it up? Is that a typical, is that an item, cash flow item that sort of goes out?
Normally we would not invest, significant capital in sprucing up the property when we are buying it, right? Mm-hmm. So we would only buy a property where we believe it is in a state that is acceptable to us, right? So that is where the diligence comes in.
Yeah.
But having said that, we do it when we are selling the property, right? So let's say I bought a property today and 4 years later I'm selling it. And in the 4 years, I see that there can be significant valuation gains that I can get by sprucing up A or B. In that case, we definitely do it, okay. Right?
And in a typical SPV structure, when there are unit holders, like investors, are you sort of on that SPV cap table as well as prop share for every property?
No, we're not.
Okay.
So we, as prop share, like I mentioned, we do not invest in specific asset-based listings.
Understood. Yeah.
But like other...
Another reason for that is also because we want to, you know, clear ourselves, because we are also the asset managers, right, in that case. And we want to play an asset manager role and not have any conflict of interest whatsoever, you know, because we are also on the cap table, yeah. Right, and that also gives the investors a lot of confidence, right? So sometimes, you know, investors come back. I mean, not so much now, but in the early years, I've been told, you know, they used to come back and say, what happens if prop share shuts down, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
You're a two-year-old company, what happens if you shut down? And even in that case, you know, we would tell, even if prop share shuts down, right, you are still going to be, the SPV is still going to own the asset, and you're still going to have the same stake in the asset that you have today. So from that perspective, all you need to do is just change the asset manager. That's about it.
Right. I mean, it's interesting because, like, I assume there's a lot of heavy lifting that goes in the initial stage of a transaction, right? Where you are supposed, I mean, in part of your diligence, obviously you'll have to look at the quality of the leases, the, you know, what are the average lock-ins, duration, et cetera, right? And rental escalations, quality of the lessors and whatnot. Once you're in, but once you are in and you are, say, operating as an asset manager for the next 4 or 5 years, things always never work as per the script, right? I mean, there are always going to be chances where, you know, some marquee tenants are going to disappear, exceptional events are going to happen, etc., right? So from that standpoint, I mean, I guess that's your edge, right, as property share. I mean, the deal origination part is something which I'm sure, there's no moat there, but effectively, this is where the moat lies, right?
Yeah, absolutely bang on, Nikhil. So I think, and this is where, you know, having, you know, our CEO who's worked for Blackstone, and he was part of the team that basically invested $1.5 billion in India at that time. And also other investment team members who have, you know, decades of experience in institutional investing helps a lot, right? So just to give you, a number, I think at a high level, we end up buying less than 2% of the assets that we actually see, right? So, you know, 98% of the assets that we see, we don't end up buying or investing in, right? So, you know, the stringency in the process ensures, right, that we bring down the risk of, you know, let's say a surprise or a shock in 2 or 3 years for our investors is minimized. Having said this, there are times, right? I mean, so when we buy assets, right, there are times when we are buying assets with a 3-year lock-in, and for whatever reason, after 3 years, the tenant decides to leave, which is where we've built in a very strong leasing team as well. So I don't mean a leasing team like all the international property consultants, but we have people who have come with that experience, who know how the leasing can be done, right? So in a couple of our assets, we've had that situation and we've been able to lease it pretty much, immediately after the tenant has left, so that we do not impact investors and the return to investors, right? Right. So, that is part of our job as asset managers. But like I said, I think that's where, the quality of tenants and the lease deeds and all that, and, the understanding of the rentals in the micro market and things like that become very important, right? And just to give you a number, I think, of all the assets that we were in during COVID, we managed to get 99.5% return or 99.5% rentals mm-hmm. on time mm-hmm. for all of the assets that we had, right? Right. So it obviously kind of clearly indicates that we must have done something right to make sure, that rents came in on time and none of the, none of the tenants kind of defaulted on that, right? So,
right. Interesting.
What is the sort of frequency of paying out to investors when it comes to rent? Is it like I collect rents monthly? So is it paid out quarterly or is it paid out?
No, so we pay out for all our Indian assets. We pay it out monthly. And for all our assets in the UK, we pay it out quarterly.
Okay. So I guess in UK, like you get a 3-month working capital benefit of sort, but I guess you collect monthly, but you sort of distribute it quarterly, right?
Yeah. So the way it works in the UK is they also pay the rents quarterly.
Okay. Right?
So it's mapped. Okay. So that's one. And also, I think the reason why we decided to do it quarterly for the UK assets is because we have a lot of international investors as well. So, non-residents who are investing, right?
Yeah.
And it made sense because, there are also multi-currency transfers and things like that. So from ensuring that you're getting the best bang for your buck in terms of charges and all that, made sense to do it quarterly.
And in terms of the offering to the investor itself, I mean, is it purely like an equity-like exposure? Or you also like do locked returns, like more credit kind of terms? In terms of, creating like a seniority of sorts on the capital structure of the SPV?
No, so basically, we don't guarantee any returns, right? Okay. So we don't guarantee any returns.
Right.
Having said that, now just take an example, right? If I'm buying an asset where, let's say, Samsung, I'm just taking a name, yeah. Samsung is the client or tenant, right? And we're buying it with a lock-in of 5 years with escalation every year. It's a 9% rental yield. What are the chances that no matter what happens, Samsung is not going to pay rent,
mm-hmm.
right? So while I again say it's not guaranteed, but I think the risk with leases like that is close to zero, right? Until unless Samsung goes bankrupt and basically closes shop,
mm-hmm.
he's anyway going to need to pay even if he exits for the entire 5 years, right? So we try to get deals where tenant profile is such that you would not imagine them going bankrupt, because that's the only way you can get out of a lock-in period, right? And we try to get deals where we are doing long lock-in periods so that our investors have that safety, right? But having said that, if in my head, right, if you look at a product, we would lie between an equity and a debt product, right? Because, we give fixed returns or let's say recurring returns, right, which are good. But then we also have the cap appreciation, right, which mm-hmm. kind of you don't get in most of the debt products, which comes in on top when you exit the instrument, right? So I would say our products that way is somewhere between the equity and the debt products that are out there. But in terms of preference on in terms of the SPV, there's not.
But you don't go for like asset backed credit at the SPV level when you're raising funds.
So right. At the SPV level, no.
Yeah. Any reason? Because in REITs, obviously there is debt being raised, right, at that level.
Yes. Yeah, so India.
And effectively, you kind of cap your cost also, right, in terms of.
You do, but see, just mathematically in India, it doesn't make sense
mm-hmm.
to acquire with debt because, you would probably get debt at 8.5%, 9%, which is pretty much equal to your rental yield, right? So We've not done anything with debt here.
Right.
Having said that, in the UK, we don't use debt, right? So in the UK, we've kind of bought all the three properties with debt because then they are rent accretive, right? I mean, then it makes financial sense to it, right? Yeah. So,
yeah, interesting.
What is sort of the...
How are cross-border funds coming to India and raising... Anyways, I'm kidding. A lot of, I mean, on the distressed end, on the distressed end, that's pretty common now, right? I mean, you have a lot of, distressed credit focused funds, which probably raise, you know, dollar or GBP money. And, you know, with a 4-5% additional hedging cost, they're deploying in India, right? And kind of, I mean, obviously you can't still, I mean, when it comes to cheapest cost of money in India, it has to be public sector banks or deposit funded banks. And that, yeah, so it can't go below 6.5-7% for sure.
But what is sort of the plan going forward? Is it sort of to sort of grow the book, acquire more assets, and over the near medium term, that's the idea? Or is it sort of enter newer geographies, India and UK, we already have boots on the ground, sort of look at, or is it get into other segments or other product lines? Like, how do you think about growth for the next?
Actually, all three, to be honest, okay. So, you know, and this is like actually one of the reasons why we did the, you know, Series B round of fundraising last year for the company, right? So we had, you know, we had $47 million, which came in by, you know, pumped in by Westbridge Capital last year. And the whole idea of doing that, you know, funding round was to ensure that we are able to do all the three that you mentioned, right? So, as you speak, you know, we're setting up our offices in the UK, we're setting up a team there so that we can then start selling in UK and Europe after that. The plan, we also have a couple of other markets in mind that we want to kind of expand into in the next couple of years. Also, we've kind of now started to invest a lot in terms of building up the team, right? So, a lot of senior level hiring that's happened. And also in India, I mean, what the funds also help us with is give us the firepower to look at much bigger assets, right? That we can acquire in India. Not because we would put that money, but you know, just to ensure that the brand reaches to a lot more investors, right? So, you know, for example, the 370 crore acquisition that we finished a couple of weeks ago that I told you about. Is just one of the steps towards that, right? So we want to definitely, I mean, we strongly believe that India is going to be a very, very important market even in the future for us. But we also see a huge opportunity in you know, going global with this model because this is something that still does not exist in a lot of countries.
Makes sense.
How was your capital raising journey in general? Like, obviously, like, I mean... There's a fair amount of validation considering the Series B and the scale of capital which has been raised. But I mean, I'm talking from the very beginning, right? Because I mean, I mean, prop tech, especially in an emerging markets geography, it's slightly risk-off kind of category for most guys. Yeah. And I understand why PE money is attractive for you. I understand that. But I mean, I'm more interested in the earlier stage when you were probably chasing venture money.
Sure. So, I think, you know, and this is, I mean, I'm just saying this, you know, from what, when I speak to Kunal and Hashim, who are the co-founders, right? So in their head, right, I mean, they were very, very clear that they do not want any sort of funding till they have established a clear model, right? And it is not that, you know, we've done an MVP to market and now let's raise money, right? So, the first round was actually raised only in 2017, right? After we already, you know, basically built the model, we had already kind of done a couple of asset acquisitions and all that, right? Because then it was, we knew that this model works, right? So until then, so 15 to 17, it was completely bootstrapped, right? And 17 is when we did the pre-Series A,
right,
which was where BNext and Pravega came in, right? And then we did Series A, I think, end of 2019, right? And that's when Lightspeed came in, right? And then 2022 is when we did the Series B, right? But I think the thought was, in terms of how the founders were thinking, right? It was very clear that we don't want money to do an MVP. We will first create the business model, show that it works, and then do and then raise funds. And since then, I mean, probably when the pre-Series A happened, the company had a AUM of maybe about 25 crores or 30 crores, right? And from there, we have now reached 1,400 crores. So it's been quite an interesting journey of scaling it up. Right?
No, super fascinating, Rahul. Thank you so much for your time. And, wish you all the best and bigger and better milestones in the future. This is a super fascinating space. We have just scratched the surface in a geography such as ours. So more bigger and exciting things for you. And with that, I would like to say, this is Nikhil Arora, and with me there's Sharad Tupran signing off.